You on tonight, but before we do, I wanted to show you something that came up just this last week that I always have fun seeing things happening right in front of our face that have been going on for, 2,500 years or so, just little short-term things like that, but that you can go back and look in the Bible and see exactly what they're talking about and see them taking place today, and it just blows my mind every time. Well, so what we've been talking about is the scattering out and the gathering in, God's promises and the covenants to the Jewish nation, and we're getting into the meat of it tonight. So we're in the Old Testament and looking at God bringing the Israelites into the promised land and all of this sort of thing. Well, here's what happened last week on Wednesday, okay? Can we have the first slide, this next slide here? Ta-da! Okay, on Wednesday, a small ancient community in the Samaria region performed a Passover offering just as it has done for over 2,000 years. Israel's small Samaritan community gathered as it does annually to offer sacrifices on Mount Gerizim, overlooking Shechem. Now then, Shechem is the Jewish city, the Jewish city that is now in the West Bank, controlled by the Palestinians, and the current name for Shechem is Nablus, and it's one of the major cities along with Ramallah in the West Bank. So if you see the town of Nablus, that's the ancient Hebrew city of Shechem. Okay, heads of Samaritan households slaughtered 35 sheep that were offered in a way very similar to that prescribed in the Torah for sacrifices at the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. Next slide. According to a press release issued by the Samaria Regional Council, the Samaritan priesthood conducts the offerings. The leader of the priests is the high priest, just as is the case in the Torah. Following the slaughter of the animals, they are roasted and eaten with matzah, as would be done if Jews today brought the Paschal lamb to the temple in Jerusalem. And then the next slide. While the Jewish Torah requires Passover offerings to be brought on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, Samaritans believe that the preeminent holy spot is Mount Gerizim. Mount Gerizim also features prominently in the Torah as a mountain upon which blessings were pronounced to the Jewish people. All right, so turn over to Deuteronomy 11. This is what's so fun to piece this through here. So Deuteronomy 11. And verse 26, God tells Moses and the Israelites, he says, "See, I'm setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you obey the commands of the Lord your God that I'm giving you today. The curse, if you obey the commands of the Lord your God and turn from the way I command you today by following other gods which you have not known. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim on Mount Gerizim the blessings and on Mount Ebal the curses." So he's telling them, whenever I bring you into this territory, one of the first things that you're going to do is I'm going to divide you into representative groups. And if you'll turn over to Deuteronomy 27, let me show you these groups that he's talking about. Deuteronomy 27 and verse 12, it says, "When you have crossed the Jordan, these tribes shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people." And he lists the tribes. And then he says, "And these tribes shall stand on Mount Ebal to pronounce curses." And so he lists these blessings and curses. And sure enough, in Joshua 8, describes when Joshua came through with the Israelites, one of the first things they did was break up into these groups. And part of the people stand on Mount Gerizim, and part of the people stand on Mount Ebal. And these mountains aren't very far apart, so people down in the valley could have seen both of them. And so it's almost like God is saying, "Now then, wherever you are in Israel and you see these mountains, they are to be a constant reminder. Blessings when you obey, curses when you disobey. So whenever you see these mountains, you remember what happened here." So he divided these groups into these people into these groups, put them on these mountains, and they pronounced all the blessings and the curses that are listed here in Deuteronomy 27 and 28, reminding them of the blessings of obedience, the curses for disobedience. Okay? So that's where Mount Gerizim first enters the picture just as they are coming into the promised land. Now then the fun part is, turn over to John 4. So we're about, with the Israelites coming into the promised land about 1440 B.C. Okay? So 1400 years later. Now then, we know the relationship and the attitude of the Jewish people toward those Samaritans. Okay? You know, everything that you hear about. They are half-breeds. They are filthy people. They're disgusting. They didn't like to mix. It was bad to do that. So the Samaritan people were always pushed aside by the Jewish people. Okay? So John 4, we have Jesus in Samaria speaking to a woman at a well. So everything is wrong. You know, man and woman at a well, Jew and Samaritan at a well, everything is just going to turn out bad. Well, Jesus tells her what her life is like, and she's kind of shocked by what he finds out and what he knows. And her response is, in verse 19, "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you're a prophet." So she quickly changes the subject and says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain." What mountain is that? Mount Gerizim. 1400 years have passed up until Jesus' time. In the meantime, the Samaritan Jews have been so outcast, they have begun worship on Mount Gerizim. That is their holy spot. Since they really can't work well in the temple in Jerusalem, since they're outcast, they have their own spot. So for almost 2400 years, this is where the Samaritans have worshipped. She says, "But you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus declared, "Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem." There's a time coming where the place of worship isn't important, when the Holy Spirit dwells in every believer. And so, in Jesus' time, here we have the exact instance of the Samaritan people, we're worshiping on this mountain. And now then, 2,000 years later, every year, the Samaritans, the Samaritan Jews is exactly who they are still sacrificing animals in the manner of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the law of Moses, the Mosaic of Laws, the law of Moses, in the prescribed manner. So the Jews in Jerusalem haven't been able to do that since 70 AD, since the temple was destroyed, but the Samaritan Jews continue to do that every single year on Passover. So it's pretty amazing seeing that history still being played out today. Now then, my first question I thought was, now wait a minute, they just celebrated Passover Wednesday? I mean, you know, Passover for the Jews was the end of March. And so I had to really research on that one. Turns out, and I don't know if you know, the Jews and the Muslims and the Samaritan Jews all operate on a lunar calendar. Okay, so they have 12 30-day months. Okay, if you operate strictly on a lunar calendar, what does that do to your holidays every single year? They change. They keep continually changing. That's why for Islam, the month of Ramadan may be, I can't remember, this year it was in October, November, I believe. Next year, I can't remember. Next year it'll be a few days earlier every single year. It'll keep moving around the calendar, okay? Because they're tied strictly to the lunar calendar. What the Jews did very early on was they have leap years to adjust their calendar. So every few years they insert an extra short month in the springtime, and it keeps their holidays adjusted to within a month every year, okay? It still travels back and forth, but it's always within a month with this leap month figured in. The Samaritans, turns out, they have a different leap month. And so at this point this year, their Passover was celebrated at the maximum distance from the Jewish Passover that it can be, right at 1 month apart. So they have a different leap month that they figure in. So I never knew that one. So their Passover floats also. Sometimes it coincides with the Jewish Passover. Sometimes it goes as far as almost a month apart. So that, because I was thinking, well, now what are they're doing it late? You know, not according to their calendar. So lots of good history to see there. So it's fun to see how it all ties together and see these little things going on that have been going on for thousands of years, and think that we think that we've got history. No way. We just got a couple hundred years, that's all. So, okay, we're going to continue on tonight with, we have looked at the promises that God gave Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and kind of shown you the highlights of it, and that was these covenants that God made with Abraham and saying, I'm going to make you the father of many nations, I'm going to make your name great, I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, I'm going to give you the covenant of this land. And he told Abram that you and your descendants are going to be gone from this land for a few generations, but I'm going to bring you back, and when they come back, it will belong to your descendants. He gave that same covenant with Isaac, and he talked about when your descendants return, it's going to be theirs. And he did the same thing with Jacob as we wound up last week. I've got a covenant, and it's going to be the same covenant that I promised Abram and Isaac, and it's going to flow through Jacob and your descendants after you, okay? So it's all there, kind of getting lined up for eternity is what it is. And he says, and it's an everlasting covenant. So let's start with Genesis 46. Next slide. Yeah, there you go. Genesis 46. And for those of you that haven't been here, what I'm going to do is I've always wanted to look at the exact promises that God makes about him scattering the Jewish nation and regathering them, and see if it holds up all the way through. I know it holds up through biblical history, but what happens in our time, can we show that exactly what he promised is going on today? And it's pretty powerful whenever you put it all together. So Genesis 46, 1 through 4. So Israel, or Jacob, set out with all that was his, and when he reached Beersheba, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in a vision at night and said, Jacob, Jacob, here I am, he replied. I am God, the God of your father, he said. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again, and Joseph's own hand will close your eyes. So he promises Jacob, if you'll just go down there, everything's going to be okay. You're a handful of people, but after I'm through with you in four generations, you're going to be a great nation. Something beyond imagination that Jacob could have thought about. Okay? But Jacob gets in on the very first of this and sees the Israelite nation beginning to grow in Egypt. So God is saying, just go with me here. Go with me. Promise it'll be okay. And then in Exodus 12, Exodus 12, sure enough, just like God had said, he had told Abram that they were going to be in a foreign country for four generations while he dealt with the sin of the Amorites, the people that were in this land at the time. He says, I've got to work with these groups here a little while longer. I need you out of the way. You're going to be grown into a great nation. And after I'm through dealing with these people that are here, I'm going to bring you back, and it will be your land. That's the promise. And sure enough, in Exodus 12:40, now the length of the time of the Israelite people lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, to the very day, all the Lord's divisions left Egypt. Okay? So we know that that was the length of time that Jacob and his people had left the promised land. It wasn't there yet, but that was coming. So they left, and then they returned later, 430 years later. So as the Israelites were trekking through the desert, God speaks to them through Moses, and this is after they leave Egypt, and they know that they're going back to the promised land, and God speaks to them, and he brings them right up to the edge of the promised land. Now then, it's not that great of a distance from where they were in Egypt, which was kind of northeastern Egypt, along the around the Nile Delta up to the Promised Land. So if you stop and think, they probably didn't take very long at all to travel up to that, to the edge of the Promised Land. But what happened was that there was a lot of grumbling and complaining. And so God said, folks, you're not ready to come in here yet. And I mean, they were there, they were on the edge of it. And he said, I can't bring you in like this. You're going to be gone for 40 more years or 38 more years, another generation. And I want you, all you grumblers, to die off. And then I'm going to bring the rest of them in, the next generation. So, makes me wonder what he would do with me. So the next generation wasn't a whole lot better. And God warns them, this next group that comes in. Leviticus 26, I think is the next slide. So, Leviticus 26. Let's start with verse 33. Leviticus 26, 33. He is going through and talking to them in great detail about all the laws, all of his demands, all of his commands. And in that, he continually tells them, here's what is going to happen if you obey. Here's what's going to happen if you disobey. All right? Over and over and over. If you read all this, it is over and over. And so buried in here in verse 33, he says, I will scatter you among the nations and will draw out my sword and pursue you. Your land will be laid waste and your cities will lie in ruins. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbath years all the time that it lies desolate and you are in the country of your enemies. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the time that it lies desolate, the land will have the rest it did not have during the Sabbath you lived on it. As for those of you who are left, I will make their hearts so fearful in the lands of their enemies that the sound of a wind-blown leaf will put them to flight. They will run as though fleeing from the sword, and they will fall even though no one is pursuing them. So one thing is that God is saying is there's always going to be somebody left. There's always going to be a remnant. But I'm going to deal with them also. They're going to remember me, and they're going to remember what it was that they did wrong that was against me. So no matter where you are, I'm going to remind you, Israel, of your disobedience. I may scatter you, but you're always going to remember me. They will stumble over one another as though fleeing from the sword, even though no one is pursuing them. So you will not be able to stand before your enemies. You will perish among the nations. The land of your enemies will devour you. Those of you who are left will waste away in the lands of their enemies because of their sins. Also because of their father's sins, they will waste away. But if they will confess their sins and the sins of their fathers, their treachery against me and their hostility toward me, which made me hostile toward them, so that I sent them into the land of their enemies, then when their uncircumcised hearts are humbled and they pay for their sin, I will remember my covenant with Jacob and my covenant with Isaac and my covenant with Abraham, and I will remember what? The land. Now, wait a minute. What about them? I mean, wouldn't that have been a little more personable if he had said, I'll remember you? I find it phenomenal when you start keying on these things. God is talking about the land again. And he says, whenever you confess and come back to me, I'll remember the land. That's real interesting. For the land will be deserted by them and will enjoy its Sabbath while it lies desolate without them. They will pay for their sins because they rejected my laws and abhorred my decrees. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them or abhor them so as to destroy them completely, breaking my covenant with them. I am the Lord their God. Man. He says, no matter what happens, I'm never going to completely destroy them because I have a covenant with these people. And evidently it is based on a piece of land. Because he says, no matter how mad they make me, I will always remember the land. That just blows me away. Absolutely blows me away. And so he says, I will never break this covenant with them because I've got it with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. No matter how mad they make me, I will always come back to them and they will come back. I will see to it because I have a covenant. God cannot break a covenant, period. God cannot do that. Once he does a covenant, it is everlasting. Now then, why does he over and over say that the land will enjoy its Sabbath rests while you're gone? What's the Sabbath rest? The rest of the land, as it replenishes itself, what over here? They didn't do that when they were there. What is a Sabbath rest? No planting for how long, how often? Every 7 years, the Jews are supposed to let the land lie fallow to give it a Sabbath rest. And God tells them, he says, if you will do this, I'll give you enough crops in the sixth year to sustain you and good growth in the eighth that you will be able to last just fine, but you're going to have to trust me. How many farmers we got? How many people have farmed, really?
I remember my uncle leaving out ground. He was a dry land farmer.
Yep.
And I remember him leaving out a portion of his land every year.
A portion?
He'd take crops around, and that's what he would say, I'm going to leave it fallow.
Yep.
This year.
It lets the land rest. It works. Now then, answer me this. Do you think, what would be the effect in the Texas panhandle of God saying, y'all just lay off for the seventh year? Everything? But that's what he told the Jews to do. He said, you let it rest. All right, now then, what would happen if it, you know, he says, no matter how long you're in the foreign lands, he said, it's going to enjoy a rest, okay? It's going to enjoy, it looked desolate, but it's resting. So what do you think the land will look like when they do come back?
Full of weeds.
Full of weeds. Just like the panhandle. You know, when they come back and start working it again, it seems like it would just absolutely explode. You know, I mean, it's been resting all that time. All right, let's see if that follows true. Okay, let's go to Deuteronomy 4. And I've always heard, and I've read some Jewish teachers, rabbis, and they say, if you want to understand what a Jew is, read the book of Deuteronomy. And it's powerful to understand what is in Deuteronomy that describes the Jewish people. It's so powerful, it really is. All right, Deuteronomy 4:1 says, hear now, O Israel, the decrees and laws I am about to teach you. Follow them so that you may live and may go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. Do not add to what I command you and do not subtract from it, but keep the commands of the Lord your God that I give you. So he's warning them again. He said, keep my commands and it will go well for you because you're about to go in and take possession of this land that I've promised your forefathers. I've said it was yours and it's yours everlasting and you're about to go take possession in it. You know, one other thing about the Sabbath year, there is a big push in Israel on, and it's been growing every single year, to return to the fallow years, the Sabbath years. The last one was in 2007, 2008. That year time frame was the Sabbath year. And I remember all of the articles and all of the rabbis that were talking, trying to get the people in Israel to do that. And it's a huge task, especially the more secular we become, to turn that loose. But they're showing, they're proving, you know, in now year 2010, that look what happened in that year. So they're proving exactly what God told them, you know, 3,000 years ago, if we'll just do it, it'll work. So even today, they're struggling with the exact same thing. All right, Deuteronomy 4:25. He says, after you have had children and grandchildren and have lived in the land a long time, if you then become corrupt and make any kind of idol, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord your God and provoking him to anger, I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you this day that you will quickly perish from the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess. You will not live there long, but will certainly be destroyed. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and only a few of you will survive among the nations to which the Lord will drive you. And again, he's saying, some of you are going to die. But there's always going to be a remnant. Always. Because he's got a covenant. He cannot destroy the Jewish people because he's got an everlasting covenant with them. So he's saying one more time, even though I drive you out, there will be a few that will survive. There you will worship man-made gods of wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or eat or smell. But if from there you seek the Lord your God, you will find him if you look for him with all your heart and with all your soul. When you are in distress and all these things have happened to you, then in later days you will return to the Lord your God and obey him. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not abandon or destroy you or forget the covenant with your forefathers which he confirmed to them by oath. He says, just remember, I will never desert you because I have a covenant and my covenants last forever. No matter where you are in the world, no matter how many of you get destroyed, I will always work with a remnant. God says, I will do that, and he cannot lie. So, it just keeps building this impact, this evidence that we have. Deuteronomy 28:58. 28:58. And if you read the book of Deuteronomy over, I'm just hitting the highlights of all of the discussions that God has with Moses and the Israelites, preparing to bring them into the land. Deuteronomy 28, and let's start with verse 58. If you do not carefully follow all the words of this law, which are written in this book, and do not revere this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God, the Lord will send fearful plagues on you and your descendants, harsh and prolonged disasters, and severe and lingering illnesses. He will bring upon you all the diseases of Egypt that you dreaded, and they will cling to you. The Lord will also bring on you every kind of sickness and disaster not recorded in this book of the law until you are destroyed. You who were as numerous as the stars in the sky will be left but few in number, because you did not obey the Lord your God. Just as it pleased the Lord to make you prosper and increase in number, so it will please him to ruin and destroy you. You will be uprooted from the land you are entering to possess. Then the Lord will scatter you among all nations from one end of the earth to the other. There you will worship other gods, gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. Among those nations you will find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing, and a despairing heart. You will live in constant suspense, filled with dread both night and day, never sure of your life. In the morning you will say, if only it were evening, and in the evening, if only it were morning, because of the terror that will fill your hearts and the sights that your eyes will see. Does that remind you, if you know anything about the history of the Jewish people, is that a blunt, accurate description of the history of the Jewish people? I mean, anything that you read about their history, no matter where they are living in persecution. Until the United States came along, we were the first nation to grant the Jewish people full citizenship rights. Nowhere else in the world has that happened. Everywhere else, this is how they have lived in the world. Everywhere else. Wherever they're scattered, they are persecuted. They have terror day and night. There is no rest. They are anxious because of the persecution. That is a great description of the history of the Jewish people. Then Deuteronomy 29:12. Warning them again and again and again. Deuteronomy 29:12 says, you are standing here in order to enter into a covenant with the Lord your God, a covenant the Lord is making with you this day, and sealing with an oath, to confirm you this day as his people, that he may be your God, as he promised you, and as he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm making this covenant with its oath, not only with you who are standing here with us today in the presence of the Lord your God, but also with those who are not here today. Okay, this opens up a whole new ball game here. God is telling this group of Jewish people, you know, the most common number of the Jewish people at this time was about 2 million, okay? So it talks in the Bible about 600,000, I think, men who left Egypt. So men, women, children, and everything. So the estimates are about 2 million people, okay? So as he's bringing them into the promised land and he's sitting them down, he says, I'm reminding you of this covenant. He said, but I'm not just making this covenant with you. These people that are sitting, he's saying, my covenant is also with those who are not here today. My covenant extends everlasting. Y'all are going to be dead. But I'm going to continue working throughout history with all of those who are not here today, the descendants, all the way through your lines. And that covenant still has to do with land. Still has to do with all of that. Over and over, he says, this isn't the end of it. This is the beginning. Yes?
I'm just curious. He's got a covenant with the land. In the Bible, he lays out the borders.
Yes.
Here to here and here to here.
Yes.
And they don't have that
now. Nope.
We'll get that back.
The question is, I mean, he lays out the borders of the promised land. And it's, you know, 10 times what Israel is today. And so then the question comes up. Well, now, wait a minute. He promised them that land. When are they going to get that? I believe it's going to, you know, we can't imagine sitting here today how in the world Israel, the nation of Israel, could control all of Jordan, all of Lebanon, all of Syria, most of Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. We're sitting there going, I don't know about that. I do too, every square inch. But who in 1947 could have conceived that Israel as a nation would have existed again also? No way. So, I don't know how, but I know that God said, here's the borders of the promised land and it's yours. I believe it's theirs. I don't know exactly how it's going to work out. Don't know that, but I believe that somehow it's going to return. It's amazing. You know, the other thing that falls in line with that is, you know, where he talks about there's not going to be rest for the sole of your feet. In Deuteronomy 11, I think it is, he talks about them, say, and he tells the Jews, he says, wherever the sole of your foot touches, this land will belong to you. He says that. He says, wherever the sole of your foot touches, that land will belong to you. Now then, here's the thing, you know, the possibilities. Where do you think that they wandered for 40 years? I mean, you can cover a lot of territory in 40 years. I mean, even I could. You can cover a lot of territory. See, we've got this mindset that they were locked up in the Sinai Peninsula around Mount Sinai. That's probably not it at all. See, there's a whole other revelation. There's a whole lot of archaeological discoveries going on in Saudi Arabia that the true Mount Sinai might be in Saudi Arabia, which makes perfect sense, okay? It says Moses went to the land of Midian. Land of Midian is Saudi Arabia. That's where he met Jethro, father-in-law, marriage, all of that. And he spent 40 years. If I was leading 2 million people through the desert, I would want to go back to where I knew there was water, campsites, food, grass. I want to go back to familiar territory. I would take 2 million people back into the land of Midian. And since God said, this is where I spoke to him on Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai, all of this happened, I better take them back to where God is, okay? So now then, that opens up a whole new realm of possibilities. Where is the land of Midian today? It's in western Saudi Arabia. Yes?
But
Yes, but Moses knew. Yeah, but Moses knew where. I mean, Moses met God on the mountain in the land of Midian. Okay, so this is where we're going. Exactly. God and Moses. I mean, Moses knew what was going on. God said, "Come with me. I'm taking you." Okay. All right. And so you add that up with also in Galatians. Paul says he's comparing Hagar and Sarah, the son of promise and the son of law, and he says Hagar's son can be compared with Mount Sinai in Arabia. That's in Galatians. And Paul went to Arabia for a few years after he converted. So he knew what was in Arabia. Well, all of a sudden you've got, well, that opens up a whole lot of territory to cover in 40 years. So, then that boggles my mind. Where did the sole of their feet rest that the land belongs to them? Guess what? Old maps of Saudi Arabia, all of the towns and the locations and landmarks and the wadis, the arroyos that we call arroyos, they all got Jewish names. Wonder how that happened. So, it just boggles the mind to think, God said everywhere the sole of your foot touches is your land. How far did they go in 40 years? I mean, that's pretty powerful. So there's a lot of things going on that just we can't comprehend. Okay, so he says, so my covenant was with those who are not here today. And then verse 22. Deuteronomy 29:22, your children who follow you in later generations and foreigners who come from distant lands will see the calamities that have fallen on the land and the diseases with which the Lord has afflicted it. The whole land will be a burning waste of salt and sulfur, nothing planted, nothing sprouting, no vegetation growing on it. It will be like the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in fierce anger. All the nations will ask, why has the Lord done this to this land? They're going to be looking at the land going, now wait a minute. This was God's land. Why did he do this? I mean, it's going to be powerful. Why this fierce burning anger? And the answer will be, it is because this people abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, the covenant he made with them when he brought them out of Egypt. They went off and worshipped other gods and bowed down to them, gods they did not know, gods he had not given them. Therefore, the Lord's anger burned against this land so that he brought on it all the curses written in this book. In furious anger and in great wrath, the Lord uprooted them from their land and thrust them into another land as it is now. Well, that sounds pretty brutal. But all of a sudden, you start seeing the connection. If they disobey, I'm going to scatter them. And while they're scattered, the land is going to suffer. When they're here and obeying, the land will produce and they will multiply. Okay, so here's what starts happening. The God says, the land is yours unconditionally. It is yours from now on, period. But the conditional part of the covenant is this. If you obey me, the land will be fruitful and will produce. If you don't, it's going to be cursed and desolate. So the conditional statement on their obedience is the produce of the land. The land is theirs. He says that. Yes?
It's like he blesses and curses the land as he does the people.
Isn't that something? But he tells them, it's all yours. I can't take it away, but I can sure make it nasty. You know? Great. So all of a sudden this starts piecing together in that manner. Now then, let's look at Deuteronomy 30 and verse 1. Again, he says, when all these blessings and curses I have set before you come upon you, and you take them to heart wherever the Lord your God disperses you among the nations, and when you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and with all your soul according to everything I command you today, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where he scattered you. Even if you have been banished to the most distant land under the heavens, from there the Lord your God will gather you and bring you back. I don't care how far it is. I'm going to bring you home. He will bring you to the land that belonged to your fathers, and you will take possession of it. He will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. If you'll just turn back to me, I will gather you from wherever you are. I know where you are. I will bring you back. And when I bring you back, I will multiply you. I'll prosper you. The land will bloom. It will produce. He said, it's your choice. Blessings, curses. What do you want? So he lays it out for him. Then in 31:14, this is one of, and I can't remember if I covered this in our last lesson, but every time I read it, it just, you know, I want to wear my steel-toed work boots because it hurts whenever I think this through. God is bringing this next generation into the promised land. And he has one last sit-down with Moses, and he says, okay, Moses, here's how it's going to work out. And he tells him exactly what's going to happen in the future with the Israelites. And in verse 14, he says, the Lord said to Moses, now the day of your death is near. Call Joshua and present yourselves at the tent of meeting where I will commission him. So Moses and Joshua came and presented themselves at the tent of meeting. Then the Lord appeared at the tent in a pillar of cloud, and the cloud stood over the entrance of the tent. And the Lord said to Moses, you are going to rest with your fathers, and these people will soon prostitute themselves to the foreign gods of the land they are entering. They will forsake me and break the covenant I made with them. On that day I will become angry with them and forsake them. I will hide my face from them, and they will be destroyed. Many disasters and difficulties will come upon them, and on that day they will ask, have not these disasters come upon us because our God is not with us? And I will certainly hide my face on that day because of all their wickedness and in turning to other gods. Now write down for yourselves this song and teach it to the Israelites and have them sing it so that it may be a witness for me against them. When I have brought them into the land flowing with milk and honey, the land I promised on oath to their forefathers, and when they eat their fill and thrive, they will turn to other gods and worship them, rejecting me and breaking my covenant. And when many disasters and difficulties come upon them, this song will testify against them because it will not be forgotten by their descendants. I know what they are disposed to do. Even before I bring them into the land, I promise them on oath. So Moses wrote down this song that day and taught it to the Israelites. I know what they're disposed to do. Now then, this just absolutely floors me. Here's God saying, Moses, here's exactly what's going to happen. But I'm going to let them come in anyway. That's what he did. He told exactly what was going to happen, and that's exactly what did happen, but he still took them across. See, if you and I were in charge, we wouldn't let that happen. We would have said, you don't deserve to come in again. If we knew that, how many people would put up with that with your kids? You know, this is what you're going to do, but I'm going to let you do it anyway? No. No way. We wouldn't have let that happen. This is, to me, is such an incredible, beautiful picture of the blood of Christ. He knew Jim McKee a long time ago. And he knew Jim McKee was a sinner. And he knew Jim McKee would accept Jesus Christ, his Savior. And he knew that Jim McKee would still sin after that. And he gave his son to die for me anyway. That is just beyond comprehension. He says, because I love them enough, I'm still going to do it. Just like he did the nation of Israel. Moses, here's what they're going to do when I bring them across. They're going to do this. They're disposed to do it. That's original sin. They're predisposed to do it. But this is their land. It's my covenant. I'm bringing them in anyway. That's what he said. My son, the blood of my son, is my covenant with you. You are sinners. You are my enemies. I'm still going to send my son to die for you. And those times that you sin afterward, you're still in my grace. We wouldn't have done it that way. That's why I believe the Bible more and more, because we wouldn't have written it this way. No way. So that is such a powerful picture of what God does with the nation of Israel, with the church, with individuals. It really is. He knew it, and he still did it anyway because he loved us so much. Then, in one specific, we got time to do this, one specific dispersion, about 1400 B.C. or so, Deuteronomy 28, 49. says, "The Lord will bring a nation against you from far away, from the ends of the earth, like an eagle swooping down, a nation whose language you will not understand. A fierce-looking nation, without respect for the old or pity for the young. They will devour the young of your livestock and the crops of your land until you are destroyed. They will leave you no grain, new wine, or oil, nor any calves of your herds or lambs of your flock until you are ruined. They will lay siege to all the cities throughout your land until the high fortified walls in which you trust fall down. They will besiege all the cities throughout the land the Lord your God is giving you." So here's an instance where he gives them a particular time and nation that he says, there's going to come a time where a particular nation is going to come in here and do this to you. Okay? Like an eagle swooping down. Now then, turn over to Ezekiel 17. So all the way over across Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel 17. And this is Ezekiel prophesying about 600 B.C. Ezekiel prophesied during the time right before and during the Babylonian invasion. The Babylonians took the Israelites into captivity in 586. So this was about 600 B.C. And Ezekiel says, 17:1, "The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set forth an allegory and tell the house of Israel a parable. Say to them, this is what the servant of the Lord says. A great eagle with powerful wings, long feathers, and full plumage of varied colors came to Lebanon, taking hold of the top of a cedar. He broke it off, its topmost shoot, and carried it away to a land of merchants, where he planted it in a city of traders." This was Ezekiel's prophecy of the coming of the Babylonian captivity, 600 B.C., so about 800 years after God said a nation like an eagle will swoop in and take and all of this kind of stuff, Ezekiel in 600 B.C. says, you know what, this is what's going to happen, and this eagle is going to swoop in. Here it is again. And sure enough, the symbol of the nation of Babylon was an eagle. And then you roll that a few hundred years more, what was the symbol of Rome? Eagle. So again and again, we have these pictures that God gives them. Here's what it's going to look like when this nation attacks. Okay? So he gives them that specific reference. So let's go ahead and look at Isaiah 11. Isaiah 11. A couple more and then we'll halt for tonight. I think this has a lot of impact on exactly what we see happening today. Isaiah 11:10. Isaiah is prophesying 700, 750 B.C., and he's looking ahead further down the road, okay? Because in 10 he says, "In that day the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his place of rest will be glorious." Okay, who's the root of Jesse? Jesus, okay? Out of Jesse, David, and the line of Jesse comes the tribe of the Judah to David, all the way down to Jesus. Okay, so the root of Jesse is Jesus standing as a banner for the peoples. So we know that this is not Babylon. We know this is beyond Babylon. I think there's a movie. Is it? Never mind. Beyond the time of Babylon, okay? And he says, "In that day the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people, from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will vanish and Judah's enemies will be cut off," all of this. So he said there's a second time that he's going to reach out and grab all these people and bring them back. Second time. Well, when was the first time? It was after Babylon. Okay? Now, some people say, no, this is Egypt. But the thing about that is, Egypt, during the, they're coming in from Egypt, that land wasn't the promised land. I mean, it wasn't inhabited by them yet. Remember? Remember God said, y'all get out of here, I need to deal with these people here, but when you come back, it's yours? So the Egypt gathering, that wasn't the first. Babylon was the first. So he says, I'm going to reach out my hand a second time. When's the second time? See, that's what we got to prove. Okay, now then, put that with Amos 9, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Hosea, Joel, Amos 9, verse 8. All the way through the prophets, all the way through the major and the minor prophets are the promise of the end gathering, scattering, regathering, God's judgment. Surely the eyes of the sovereign Lord are on the sinful kingdom. I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Yet I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. Remember? He's always going to have a few because he can't break his covenant. He can't wipe them out totally. For I will give the command and I will shake the house of Israel among the nations, so scatter them among the nations, as grain is shaken in a sieve, and not a pebble will reach the ground. All the sinners among my people will die by the sword. All those who say disaster will not overtake or meet us. In that day I will restore David's fallen tent, so the line of David, the Israelite nation. I will repair its broken places, restore its ruins, and build it as it used to be, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations that bear my name, declares the Lord, who will do these things. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. I will bring back my exiled people, Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. Sounds awfully familiar. I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God. Whoa. Now wait a minute. Hang on. Let's put this together. He says in Isaiah, I'll bring them back a second time. I'm going to reach out my hand a second time. We know the first time was Babylon, that he gathered them back just like he said he would. The second time, he says, when it happens the second time, they come back and they're never going to be uprooted again. Well, then what? Then what after that? See, all of a sudden, he gives this description of exactly what's happening in Israel today. I mean, all of that. That's what's happened in the last 60 years. And he says, and when I bring them back, they're never going to be uprooted again. And, you know, tied in with all of this is the day of the Lord. It is. All the way through all of these prophecies. So you're going, oh my goodness, you know, what are we seeing today that's right here before our eyes? And that's what I'm going to continue to show you, because when you see exactly what's happened in the last 60 years in Israel, it will flat blow your lid off. So it really is amazing. Okay? All right, we're going to stop there. And next week I'm going to continue on, because there's a lot of these prophecies that he continues to give about what it's going to be like when I scatter, what it's going to be like when I gather. Okay? Over and over. And then we're going to put it together and see, okay, has that been happening? Let's look at the evidence and see what we see. But he's already said, you know, when I bring them back the second time, they're not going to be scattered again. They're home. That opens up your mind a lot. So, okay, any questions? Yes?
Did they scatter themselves? I understand the timetable you're saying right now, but after they got back from Babylon, how did they get back out?
Okay. The second scattering, the second major scattering, of course, was in 70 A.D. All of the years leading up to 70 A.D. And I'm going to show you. Next week, Jeremiah prophesies that when they are scattered in captivity in Babylon, it's just going to be for 70 years. I mean, God gives them a timeline for that. And sure enough, Daniel, in his writing says, okay, the 70 years, we're expecting that. Sure enough, 70 years later, the temple, they began worshiping in the temple back in Israel. Nehemiah prepared, got everything, the walls, all the everything taken care of. They were back. They lived there until 70 AD, and that's when the Romans came in and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and shoved everybody out, and under persecution they fled and scattered. The thing is, they all didn't leave. There have always been Jews in Israel. However few they are, they've always been there. But the last major scattering was started in 70 AD, in the years leading up to that. And so for 2,000 years, the land of Israel has almost been devoid of Jews. There still have been Jews in there all this time, but most of them have been scattered. So we'll show you the numbers. Yes? Yes. It is amazing to ask the question, why would a Jew living in the most prosperous, most secure country in the world want to go back to Israel? I mean, really? And then you start looking at statistics that during the Lebanon War, just a couple of summers ago, you know, when Hezbollah started firing rockets and Israel invaded and it was a big mess. During that month was the highest influx of North American Jews to Israel. You're going, couldn't you pick a better time? But you have to ask, why would they do that? I mean, what could possibly drive them to go back to leave the United States? To me, the only answer is, that's home. God told us. That's all you can come up with.
These people grow up in Israel.
No, they're absolutely, and they're saying we want to go home. Well, wait a minute. Why exactly? Yes.
God said, "I know the plans I have for you."
Yes.
They know. God knows.
They know. And you know, of course, to me too. Also, yeah. I don't know. There are Jews living in the United States that you know are not really attached to their Jewish history. Why would they have an urge to go back to Israel? You know, why would they have that urge? And again, I think there's this connection there that God has with them that they can't even explain. Yeah. So, yes, sir. Yep. So I think God knows where every single one is, and He's going to try to get. I don't think all of them will return. I think there's the old and feeble, and those who are so secular that, you know, they're just not going to go back. So how many are left? I've got the numbers to show you. What? Yes.
The reference in Amos there of David's tent.
Yes.
Is that the tabernacle? Does that mean they're returning to a true worship of God?
I think that is number one. David's dwellings, and number two, the picture of the rebuilt temple. Because all the prophecies say that there's going to be a temple, and all the Jews know it. And that's part of the tension. Yeah, that's what's scary is the Arabs know it too, and they're scared to death. Yep. Anything else? Yes, ma'am. The Jewish people, there's a couple of groups that have everything prepared for the temple. About the only thing they lack is the red heifer for the ashes for the cleansing. All the implements are done, all the furnishings. The Sanhedrin that was just formed in 2006 after 1,400 years. Why in the world did the Sanhedrin reform? Because they said, God told us. You know, that's the way it's supposed to be. When the constituency of the Jews get back to Israel in large enough numbers, the Sanhedrin is required to reform. One of their first lines of duty was to hire an architect to design a temple out of tilt-up construction. You know what tilt-up construction is?
Tilt-up.
Really? Yes. You know why?
What is
Well, that's where, you know, one day Walmart doesn't exist and the next day Walmart's there because those big, huge concrete panels get tilted up in place. Okay. It's the same thing. So they have these pre-cast panels ready to go. And they, see, that's the other thing. And I don't know the answers to this, but I'm thinking, because most people think, you know, how could they work on a temple for 2 or 3 years? I mean, how long is it going to take to just put this one addition on? So, I mean, how could we wait this long to do this? How could they build a temple for 2 or 3 years and get away with it? How about if they did it overnight? I don't know the answer to that, but that was one of the first orders of the Sanhedrin to design the temple with tilt-up construction. They could get it up fast, okay? Their second order was, with any degree of certainty, to find a male in Israel who can trace his line to David. And they've got a few that can do that. In fact, I think I told you last time, there's a Jew in Amarillo that can trace his lineage to the line of David. He and his wife are saving money to return to Israel. It goes back to your question. Why would a kid in Amarillo, a Jew in Amarillo, want to go back to Israel? And guess what? He's in the line of David. Why are they interested in the line of David? Because the next king of Israel has to be of the line of David. They're ready. They know the qualified pool to choose from. Just like they have the priests ready. They know the qualified pool that they can pick the high priest from today. They know that. They know the Kohens, the priests. They know those people in Israel. So they know whenever the temple is ready, we know who we can have for priests legally. And whenever there's a king of Israel ready, we know the pool that we draw from. They already know this stuff. They're ready to do it. It's fascinating. So, but, I mean, all they're doing is following this right here. They're just saying, we're just doing what God told us. So, yeah, they're right on it. It's fun to see. Anything else? Let us have a prayer and we'll turn you loose. Almighty God, it is so exciting to read your word continually. We know that every time we read your word, that your wisdom comes through. God, just open our hearts and our minds and our wisdom, because we desire to be closer to you. We desire to mine everything that we can from your word. We know that so much of what you do is beyond our comprehension, because our thoughts are not your thoughts, God. But we long to be close to you. We long to be intimate with you through your word. So we thank you that you have given us this word to sustain us and give us endurance. And also, God, we thank you for these signs that you give us so that we can see you working today in front of our very eyes, knowing that your covenant that you formed 4,000 years ago is still true today, everlasting as you call it. We thank you that you are our God. In Jesus' name, amen.